Welcome. This is Stan Lee of Marvel Comics warning you to look around you, your classmates, your friends. You never know which one of them may be a mutant.
Cyclops, Marvel Girl, the Angel, the Beast, Iceman, and their mentor, Professor Xavier. When banded together, these merry mutants become the X-Men, defenders of a world that hates and fears them. Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters, a bi-weekly show devoted to covering the X-Men saga from the beginning, one issue at a time. With your hosting trifecta, Michael Bailey, John M. Wilson, and J. David Weider.
Hello and welcome to episode 6 of Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters. My name is John Wilson.
I am Michael Bailey.
I am J. David Weider.
And this is the podcast that takes you through every adventure of the strangest superheroes of all time from their inception in the early 1960s. This is an episode we're going to be looking at issue 5 of the X-Men, which I'm really looking forward to talking about.
Absolutely, yes. And this time around, I have the synopsis, so why don't we just jump right in. X-Men number 5, cover dated May 1964, went on stands on or around March 3rd, 1964. The title of the story is Trapped, One X-Man. Spellbinding story by Stan Lee. Dazzling drawing by Jack Kirby. Inked by Paul Reinman. Lettered by Sam Rosen. Edited by Stan Lee with a cover by Kirby and Reinman. And this issue, action, surprises, a suspense, all in the magnificent Marvel manner. At least that's what the cover promises, along with the fact that we will see the most unusual teenagers of all at their fighting best when they learn the Angel is trapped. Now the cover is predominantly powder blue with the X-Men logo in white with purple accents. The Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, Magneto, Toad, Mastermind, Quicksilver, and a green-clad Scarlet Witch all look through a window into a room where the Angel is trapped, pounding against the glass with a foreboding crimson light shining on him. The remainder of the X-Men rush in on the Brotherhood, ready to rescue their commandeered comrade, as, and I quote, "Magneto and his evil mutants, more dangerous than ever, strike again." So let's crack this cover and look at X-Men number 5. As the issue opens, the X-Men, those strange mutant teenagers, solemnly return to Xavier's school for gifted youngsters with an injured Professor Xavier in tow. The mood is grim as the X-Men face defeat last issue at the hands of Magneto and his Brotherhood of Evil Mutants in the South American town of Santo Marco. At the door of the X-Mansion, Iceman tells his teammates that he can't get to his key without defrosting, so Cyclops uses a thin, controlled burst of optic blast to disable the lock. Once inside the mansion, Jean telekinetically lifts the sleeping professor from his wheelchair. Scott tells Jean to be careful and not to jostle the professor. She has all the time in the world. As Jean gently lays the X-Men's leader into bed, the Beast removes the professor's jacket, and the professor rests. The X-Men look upon the professor's slumber and address the fact that they must continue their teacher's fight against evil mutants, but without their leader, it will be an uphill job. Just then, the Beast hears a car approaching the mansion. The X-Men go on alert. The evil mutants may have found them, but alas, it's only Marvel Girl's parents paying a surprise visit to the school. The X-Men scurry about, changing out of their X-Men uniforms into their civilian identities.
And as far as we know, they're not evil mutants.
As far as we know, the Greys are not evil mutants at this time. Warren harnesses up his wings, Bobby defrosts, Scott puts on his protective sunglasses, and Hank puts on a cardigan. And Jean greets the Greys at the door and introduces her classmates to her doting, clueless parents. Jean's mom, curious about Scott's unique sunglasses, reaches out for them, and Scott recoils and explains that he has an eye infection. Hank, thinking quickly, changes the subject and takes the Greys on a tour of the school, including the danger room, which Hank explains away as a gym awaiting new equipment. As the tour progresses out of the danger room, Scott is forgotten and left behind. This is bad news because when the danger room door shuts, it locks Scott in and activates the room's many mechanisms. Fire pits open, projectiles fly across the room, and multiple traps are sprung. The floor itself whips Scott into the air, and the trapeze he grabs for turns out to be a dummy, like the piece of paper Beast mistakenly thought was a rope last issue. This is really unfortunate since a set of giant iron rollers are barreling right for Scott. So Scott begins optic blasting everything in sight, which creates even more danger as his optic blasts begin to weaken, and, well, luckily, the Danger Room releases Scott before any more danger is set upon him, and he's relieved since the room is soundproof and Gene's parents won't be alerted to the mansion's violent secrets. As the Greys drive away, they gush about how fortunate their daughter is to get a free scholarship to such a great school. The Greys also think that Charles Xavier is a charming man and that her classmates are clean-cut, well-mannered young men. The Greys pass a lone pedestrian who is searching the neighborhood with merciless, unblinking eyes. This is Mastermind, who we met last issue, and he's seeking out the X-Men with no success. Mastermind contacts Magneto using a wrist communicator, and the Master of Magnetism orders Mastermind to return. Quicksilver is sent to fetch the evil mutant in an odd, very ostentatious flying craft. The craft carries the two into space and towards a jagged asteroid, which houses a space station where Magneto and the rest of the Brotherhood are hiding out. This is Asteroid M, and I would recommend getting very familiar with this hideout. As soon as Mastermind and Quicksilver set foot on Asteroid M, Toad greets them right out of the airlock by hopping on Mastermind's head. Once again, there is bickering amongst the Brotherhood as Mastermind retaliates by convincing Toad that he is wrapped tightly in a heavy cloth. Like a stern father, Magneto breaks up the quarrel and tells his team that he has a new plan to capture the X-Men. Pietro dissents and says that they should forget the X-Men and move on, but Magneto basically tells Pietro to stuff it. As long as the X-Men are out there protecting humanity, none of them are safe. Magneto adds that they will use Toad to trap the X-Men, but if he or any of the Brotherhood fail, they will face the wrath of Magneto, the most powerful mutant of all. Not long afterwards, back at the Xavier School, Bobby tries to convince a brooding Scott to watch a great track meet on TV. Scott blows up at Bobby, accusing him of being immature because who can think of a track meet when the professor has lost his powers? Hank consoles Bobby after Psych fires a low-level optic blast at the door, shoving Bobby into the hallway where the two join Warren, Jean, and Professor X in the study where the track meet is in full swing. Warren points out a racer bringing up the rear, who ends up winning the race by hopping over the other runners. The racer goes on to own at the high jump, the broad jump, and the hurdle race, and the X-Men deduce that only a mutant could leap like that. The crowd grows angry, proving Xavier's thesis that the human race is not ready to accept mutants, and the crowd starts getting nasty, assuming that there has been some kind of trick. The X-Men suit up because they know they have to help their fellow mutant, and they stage a daring daytime rescue in which Angel swoops down from the sky and picks the runner up, but he's heavier than expected, so the Beast has to run some interference with the crowd, as Scott and Jean drive a convertible onto the field. The teens narrowly escape into a subway train where the crowd stares at the colorfully dressed heroes. And the Beast can't seem to shake the idea that the runner looks disturbingly familiar, and he pulls off a rubber mask to reveal the Toad. Toad bounds out of the train car and into the train station as the X-Men pursue. Iceman manages to hurl an ice disc onto the floor in front of Toad, which sends him spinning across the floor. Just then, a huge clock in the middle of the station flies apart, controlled by Magneto, who was waiting in the station. Dodging the clock, parts flying through the air as the projectiles, doesn't prove to be too much of a problem for the mutants, but Magneto uses a giant iron train gate to ensnare the Angel and bring him down. Magneto didn't come alone. The Scarlet Witch uses her hex power to cause a man's suitcase to burst open and trip up the Beast. Iceman is confounded when multiple masterminds surround him, and he can't tell which one to swing his ice club at. Marvel Girl dramatically enters the fray by lifting Mastermind into the air, and Quicksilver attacks Cyclops, who is holding the Toad, which distracts Marvel Girl, allowing Mastermind to break free. Cyclops manages to hold onto Toad and blast his beams at Quicksilver, which narrowly miss the speeding mutant. Magneto signals a retreat, leaving Toad behind but hoisting the disabled Angel over his shoulders. Beast tries to pursue the Brotherhood, but Mastermind creates an illusion of an elephant running free in the train station, causing the crowd to panic, blocking the path. Marvel Girl makes a last-ditch effort to lift the Beast over the crowd with her telekinesis, but to no avail, the Beast is too heavy. And the X-Men watch helplessly as the Brotherhood blasts off with the Angel in their clutches. On Asteroid M, Magneto proceeds to torture the Angel with flashing lights and high-pitched sirens to find out where the X-Men's secret base is. The Angel struggles but remains resilient as the rest of the X-Men try to question the Toad back on Earth. Toad is obsessed with returning to Asteroid M to the point that he calls down a drone to pick up the capsule to retrieve himself, regardless of the fact that the X-Men are standing right in front of him, The X-Men hop aboard the capsule and join Toad's wild ride back to the asteroid, where Mastermind is surprised to see...
Mr. Toad's wild ride,
yep.
Cute.
Yep. Where Mastermind is surprised to see the Toad has escaped the X-Men's clutches. The X-Men use the element of surprise to attack the Brotherhood. Mastermind convinces the Beast that his legs are goo, which Hank Throat knows is an illusion, but he's powerless to overcome it. Even harder to overcome is the real gun Mastermind pulls out and begins to fire. Beast, of course, uses his reflexes to avoid the bullets, and Cyclops destroys the gun with an optic blast. Mastermind flees and warns Magneto that the X-Men are coming, which Magneto already knows, and he is firing up his magnetic intensifier to control all of the metal on Asteroid M, beginning with a sheet of metal that wraps itself around Cyclops' face. Jean is snagged by a makeshift metal claw, which confuses her to the point that she can't use her telekinesis. The Beast and Iceman are blocked from helping Jean by a set of flame jets, which the Beast deduces can be stopped by Iceman's ice bolts. The two are helping their teammates when Magneto seals them into the section and prepares to suck them out of the airlock, finds himself stopped by the Scarlet Witch, who cannot allow him to resort to cold-blooded murder, and hexes his control panel to short out. Magneto is about to teach the witch a lesson when Quicksilver stands between them and tells the Master of Magnetism that he'll do nothing to Wanda so long as Quicksilver still lives. As Magneto is arguing with the two, the X-Men come crashing through the door and Cyclops manages to grab a hold of Quicksilver, explaining that Magneto is making criminals out of he and his sister. Quicksilver tells Cyclops that he hates Magneto, but due to the debt his sister owes for her life, he must stay with the evil mutant. Magneto, meanwhile, tries to tell Wanda to hex Cyclops, but she fears that his close proximity to Quicksilver may cause her to hit her brother. And Beast tries to burst the unbreakable glass that is holding Angel in his cell, but Marvel Girl uses some heavy tanks and telekinesis to free her teammate. The post-rescue witty banter between teammates is cut short when a grotesque creature enters the room, which Warren quickly correctly deduces is one of Mastermind's illusions, and flies right for Mastermind, who Magneto saves by throwing a dart grenade into the room, forcing the teenage heroes to cover. Another problem develops as Magneto realizes that the rumbling sound that he hears is the asteroid falling apart. This is something he can use to his advantage if he can get the X-Men into the other side of the airlock, but only manages to throw Cyclops into the crumbling part of the asteroid. And Iceman forms an ice tube between the two sections, which allows Warren to fly to the other side and rescue Cyclops as the asteroid falls apart and the X-Men escape in one of Magneto's escape pods. And while the day is saved, the X-Men realize the evil mutants will be back, and this is only round two. Next time, they will be more dangerous. The X-Men return to the school to report their adventure to Professor Xavier, who tells his students that he was with them the whole time and never lost his powers. It was all one final exam. The X-Men have passed with flying colors, and now they can think and act for themselves, so their training period is over. But, true believers, this issue, as the issue closes out, we are promised that greater dangers await the X-Men, and the saga of the X-Men is just beginning. You can also You can also find this story reprinted in Marvel Superheroes number 24, Amazing Adventures number 9 and 10, and Marvel Masterworks Volume 3, X-Men Volumes 1 or numbers 1 through 10 hardcover. So why don't you? Who wants to lead us off this week?
Let's see. I did find the cover pretty interesting. Usually when someone is trapped, the camera is outside, showing, you know, everything that's going on outside, and you'll see the person like peeking out through a window or through bars or something. And here it's just the opposite, where we're inside with the Angel looking out at everything that's going on. It's too bad that the colorist still doesn't know what color Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver are supposed to be, but oh well.
Well, the Quicksilver doesn't bother me as much, but isn't there a name? There's usually a description given that this is Scarlet Witch. Wouldn't the name tip somebody off?
Yeah, unless it's like, you know, that guy from Teen Wolf. I said mauve, not turquoise. We do have a new little, I don't know what this is called. It's not the masthead, but the little picture above the Marvel Comics Group logo.
The character profile is what I used to call it.
Yeah, it's new this month.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. And I like it. It takes the Angel out of the picture because he's over flying over the X-Men.
That's pretty nice. I like that. What is Iceman doing to the Beast in it, though?
About to climb on top.
Okay.
Go for a ride? I don't know.
They're playing Leapfrog?
Yeah, is Mike here?
I'm like really creeped out by this entire conversation.
I just didn't catch it at first, and all of a sudden I'm looking at it, I'm like, man, that's really, And then Scott and Gene are looking awkwardly at the reader. That's great.
Hello? Speaking of Scott looking at the reader, that splash page, he looks like he's about to kill you.
Yeah. Yes, he does.
And this is the first time we don't open with a training sequence. We open with this really solemn, really quiet scene, really. It definitely strikes the right tone for what's happening here.
Everyone except for Iceman. Iceman is posing for the camera.
A little bit, yeah. Hi.
Look at me, I'm a snowman.
Speaking of Iceman, page two, he can't open the door to the mansion without defrosting. Do they only have one key? I mean, they're vandalizing the door on account of Bobby not wanting to defrost.
Speaking of Bobby and his frost, he has lost his boots since the battle on the island, and I'm pretty sure they're gone.
Oh, but the Beast found his gloves.
Which is weird, because he took them to Santa Marco, because in the planning session, he had them. It wasn't until he actually went to go attack the castle that he was suddenly without his gloves. So he packed them and took them with him. He just didn't wear them in the fight.
Bizarre. Because I never picture Beast with gloves.
Yeah, with his hand and feet being such a key part of his powers, you'd think he'd let those babies fly.
It probably helps with his tactile and his grip. So anyway,
I'm wondering about the professor here, because wouldn't it make sense, like, since he was, after all, caught in a large explosion, that he might have a concussion or something bad? I'm wondering if maybe they should take him to the hospital, because I'm pretty sure that my mama told me that if I ever threw myself in front of an explosion to protect my mutant students, that I should seek medical attention afterwards.
Yeah, but moms always say stuff like that, so I think she's just being overcautious.
Maybe. But the movies also say that if you have a concussion, you shouldn't be allowed to sleep. So
this is true. You gotta keep them awake, no matter how annoyed they get.
I don't think the professor's breathing, guys. What do we do?
Put a bandage on his head, and we're gonna pretend that everything's okay.
Just work him like a puppet like anyway. Weekend at Bernie's.
That would be great. Weekend at Xavier's. They all pretend he's alive.
Someone says he's faking, and he says, "Someone's like, how did you know?"
It bothers me that Iceman's looking down and says, "It's strange to see him sleeping like that, like a normal Homo sapien. How do mutants sleep? What am I missing?"
I was thinking it was kind of a racist thing to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, mutants sleep in like leather bondage gear. It's kind of creepy, and you don't really want to be part of it. Safety word is banana.
And you can see that with the Angel whenever he's, changing clothes.
Speaking of changing clothes, page three, I'm sorry, I'm going to say this 1,000 times, you will never convince me that Angel can harness those wings in a way to make it look like he doesn't have them without them being pinched to the point where he's probably going to have to get them removed because of gangrene.
They would never do that to him.
No.
Hey, Mike.
Yeah?
Your favorite comic book character is a man who stuffs his cape into his pants every day.
Hey, John?
Yeah?
Shut up.
And now he has a collar. Just saying.
it's fancy kind of nanite costumes where you can press a button and the collar goes down. It's kind of...
Oh, yeah, like the entire DC universe now has extremists for their costumes.
Exactly.
What's the point of Gene's parents coming? Because it's like the Achmonics on an episode of ALF. They gotta hide.
Which really confuses me, because, okay, I realize that they might not realize the extent of the school here, but shouldn't Jean's parents have some understanding of her abilities?
Unless she kept them hidden from her.
I have a hard time believing that a girl would develop telepathy in a vacuum. That, I mean, we don't have the Bizarre Adventures 27 story yet, with the whole trauma of how she discovered her powers. That hasn't been written yet. But I just, trying to read into how this would happen, I don't know.
I always kind of imagine it that, you know, she's, okay, today's the day I'm going to tell them, and that's when she hears, quote-unquote, her mother think, man, if my daughter turns out to be a telepath, I'm going to burn her at the stake. Maybe today's not the day.
But speaking of her parents, I hope you enjoyed this moment with them, because you will not see them again for 100 issues.
Her mom's kind of hot.
Yeah. She's got that Mrs. Olsen young but gray look going on.
Oh, yeah. Jimmy's mom has got it going on. The danger room sequence is amusing, but really, really unnecessary.
I just find it interesting that simply closing the danger room door with someone inside activates a predetermined automatic series of deadly attacks.
That's bad planning.
And by interesting, I mean in an, oh my god, what were you thinking, Professor Xavier, kind of way.
Yeah, you'd think there'd be a safety feature to deactivate the danger room, but this is an era when children rode in cars with...
I was going to say, Scott's in there saying, banana, 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 and the Beast's weapons are still going after him.
Well, this is an era when children rode in cars with, like, really sharp-edged metal dashboards and no seatbelts, so.
Yeah, when I was, like, when I
with
was...
a beer in the holster.
Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking, when I was a little kid, I was very short for my age. Not like I'm not short for my age now, but my parents were afraid I wasn't going to clear the coffee table. But, I would stand up in the front seat while the car was in motion. And no one ever said, Mike, you need to sit down. I would have died. Just even if my dad or mom hit the brakes, death.
Death.
So, yeah. I mean, this is an era where they thought a really good children's toy is a spear.
I do kind of feel bad for Scott, because he's basically the middle child of the X-Men. They forgot him in the danger room. It's like he's Macaulay Culkin from Home Alone. Down the hall, Beast walking, his eyes go wide, and he yells out, Scott!
Okay, now check this out. At the bottom of page 5, the left panel says, my power beam is growing weaker. If the test doesn't end soon, I'll never have to worry about menacing innocent people with my eyes again. So does this morose, God, my eyes are cursed man, all he has to do to get rid of his power is leave them open for a while?
I think he's referring to the fact that he'll die.
Yeah, like something's going to hit him and kill him.
Okay.
Oh, no.
It says my power beam is growing weaker, so I linked that with the...
No, he's trying, you know, all these things are flying at him. If his power beam goes weaker, because I can speak.
Oh, yes, I see what you're saying. Okay, you're right. That makes sense.
He does kind of stumble out like he's drunk, though. It's over. My hangover is over. Sorry we couldn't say hello to Professor Xavier. He's such a charming man. You've met him for like 5 minutes. But then again, yeah. I guess charm. He has more than charm, dear. Something about him gives a person a feeling of confidence in him. He almost seems to know what you're thinking. I really wish Josh was here right now. Because I really want him to do his little ironic speech.
Yes.
But wait a second.
Well, here's I got. This brings up a question, though. Because the Grays say they got a communication from Washington, D.C., they knew it was the best thing for their daughter. Do you think Professor X planted the idea in their head? I mean, this is apparently the first... Yeah, this is the first time they've set foot into the school. So who sends their daughter to a sight unseen school run by a mysterious rich man? I mean, this place could have been the Playboy Mansion for all they knew, and it's just lucky that Hank left the grotto off the tour.
I'm... I'm... we say it every episode. Professor Xavier is a manipulative bastard. I mean, I would not put it above this Professor Xavier to mess with their minds to convince them to send their daughter to the school.
Just going back a little bit to what I was saying earlier about how her developing her powers with her parents' knowledge. Let's say that they did know, and let's say that Xavier detected it and went out there and started, you know, meeting with her, like kind of what was depicted at the beginning of X-Men 3. I'm not exactly sure what the comic book version of that story is, but that's the version I have in my head. So what if Xavier is erasing this worry from her parents' minds every time he goes out there, so that after the initial trauma, they no longer have any clue that there's anything wrong with her daughter?
Well, there's nothing wrong with their daughter, to quote Magneto.
Right.
Sorry.
She's beautiful the way she is. I prefer the real Megan. Not Megan. What's Raven. Her name? Raven.
That's a reference to X-Men First Class.
I know. I was just thinking about how incredibly hot the actress that played Mystique was.
Yeah.
And like, hot. Damn.
In like the real world girl type hot.
Mm-hmm.
She had some glamour to her, though. I mean, yeah, real world girl, I guess, but she had some movie star look to her, too. In any case, I would not kick her out of bed on a Sunday morning.
I will say this, though, to kind of finalize the First Class talk. When she was finally walking around at the end, in the kitchen, when she had her little confrontation with Charles, it felt like a nude scene.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of made the scene in the beginning of the film feel really, really creepy.
Oh. A little bit. On second viewing, yeah.
I was about to mention that as cool as Asteroid M is, I really don't like this entire scene.
I hate the Toad. I really freaking hate the Toad. He's like a manic jackrabbit.
It's not, like, bad, but again, we're getting a lot of repetition over the course of the story. And I don't know if I would mind it less if it was different characters doing the same thing, because there is a certain formula to these stories. But I don't know. It just seems like this whole scene was there to just prove that Magneto's in charge. And we already kind of knew that Magneto was in charge. I mean, I would have much preferred to cut to the scene where Scott slams the door on Bobby. And I will admit that if somebody came into my room and said, "You want to watch a great track meet on TV," I'd probably kick him out too. Because that sounds about as much fun as not at all.
But he... But he's so melodramatic in this scene. How could you do this while Professor? It makes me think of the Batman pic that floats around the internet for the longest time. My parents are dead. Yeah.
I have a suggestion here, with the whole why Scott is so angry at Bobby here, because the I was going to have to bring this up at some point. The official index of the Marvel Universe that I have suggests that Strange Tales 120, which we're going to look at in a bit, is supposed to fit into this story somewhere. And I'm thinking it fits in with the not long afterwards at the top of page 9. That, before this track meet thing, that's where they go off. Iceman goes off and does his teenage thing and tries to get laid on the ship and meets the Human Torch. Everything we're going to talk about a little bit. So, like, he's been having teenage life and this really rubs Scott the wrong way because they're all supposed to be sad and depressed. So the whole track meet thing was like the last straw for Scott. That's my retcon.
I will admit that, in that panel where Bobby's kind of got knocked on his ass, Hank's walking along and Hank doesn't care about anything going on in this hallway right now.
Don't hold it against him, Bobby.
He can't alter his psychological makeup. Now shut up. But yeah, they're drinking some hot chocolate and watching a track meet. This is about as exciting as... I got nothing.
there are people actually who enjoy watching sports on television.
But not
okay. I enjoy watching football on television. I'll watch a boxing match. I will not watch track.
What about golf? Will you watch golf on TV?
No, but that's from childhood trauma.
See, I think watching things like golf and bowling on TV is just stupid. not stupid in as a, if you're listening to this, you should stop now kind of way, but just like those to me are sports that you really have to be engaged in for them to be interesting. Like when I'm bowling with people at a bowling alley and it's not my turn, I'm bored. I'm not going to sit at TV and watch other people have turns without it ever being my turn.
I will say this though. The X-Men are fast becoming the Legion of Superheroes in that if anybody if they think anybody's a mutant, they'll go get them no matter that they're going to, you know, double cross them later. Whereas the Legion will let anybody into the group that asks, and then they're surprised when Nemesis Kid turns out to be a traitor. How could we have prevented this?
I've said it before, Mike. If you're going to hire in your space cop team a guy named Sinestro, it's going to go bad.
You're just asking for trouble.
Who names their kids that anyway?
Borargians?
I guess. Actually, in their language, Sinestro probably means pretty pink boy or something like that.
But that's all of them. Yeah, I don't know. Was it on Legends of the Batman where you guys, John, you and a bunch of people were talking about rubber masks just not working out?
Yeah.
As a disguise?
I think it was on the Mighty Shield. I think Kaiser and I were talking about that. But it might have been Batman. I don't remember.
It all kind of flows together now. But the thing is that throughout this entire scene, this track kid has the body of a teenager. And then suddenly when the mask comes off, he has the like misshapen body of the Toad.
It's old man Dithers. He owns the haunted amusement park.
No, it just bugs me that his body should not have changed with the mask.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
It didn't. If you looked at the next page, if you look at them side by side, it doesn't look that misshapen. Oh, a little bit. Never mind. He could have unopened his girdle.
I actually have a really hard time with the track meet scene. And okay, so the school is in, like, Westchester County, but not in New York City. But somehow they managed to make it to the racetrack in time to save the Toad from a mob that was already starting their attack live on television while they were at the school. And it seems to me to be kind of rather impossible. And especially because, like, heading back up, they make a big deal about having to take the subway and how they're attracting the commuters' attention. And then, wherever the race was located, they have to make a train change in Grand Central Terminal before heading north. So getting to the race should have taken a lot longer than the 30 seconds it seemed to take.
Well, they had the car.
And it... Okay. But how do they drive from the school to the racetrack that quickly?
I'm not arguing when it's located. I just want to point out that they had a car and they decided to take a train. What?
It's located some area where they can't take a direct train, so they're going to have to detour through Manhattan. I mean, the reason this bothers me is because Stan and Jack, these guys live in New York. They should know better than that. But that's just the geography nerd. Again, he'll go away now.
Well, no, I just want to know...
But he's so awesome.
Where did the car come from? Was that Professor X's car? Did they drive there? And then why did they leave the car when that's a perfectly acceptable vehicle to escape in?
Because they like to use ice cream trucks.
Dang it.
Sorry. Previous episode.
I was there.
I know. I'm telling the listeners in case they're new. I know you were there.
Dumbass.
But Larry the listener might not have been there, so just saying.
I don't think you're giving Larry the listener enough credit, John.
Sorry, Larry. Love you, man.
and he just went through getting laid off at the plant. You've just made his life worse.
Larry was laid off at the lab. Love you, Larry.
Thanks, Stan.
I was reading a Golden Age Superman story to my daughter tonight that had a bunch of LLs in it before that was a thing. So, like, I wanted it to be a thing, and then Siegel was just using LLs without realizing that it was a thing for Superman. It bothered me. Anyways, carry on.
What were we? I don't even remember where we were. Oh, okay. You have more notes, Mike?
Not until we get towards the end of the issue, actually.
Magneto takes apart the clock in Grand Central Terminal. I thought that was awesome.
That is cool. I like that.
Yeah, it made me think of X-Men, the first X-Men movie where they had the fight in the train station. I wonder if this was one of the source materials.
I pity the fool who has to put that son of a bitch back together, though.
Oh, gosh. They probably just buy a new one.
It was custom made. They'll just custom make another one. In this fight here with the train station, I don't know whether to say that the X-Men perform pretty pitifully here or that Stan and Jack have, like, made a team that's pretty evenly matched. Because
I'll go with the latter
on
that one.
I was going to say, this is definitely more mano a mano, and it's pretty, it's evenly matched to some extent.
I mean, it makes for a better fight if they're evenly matched. I think one of the problems, and I don't know if you guys have this issue, but they do it in comics and they do it in animation and stuff. And they kind of do it in like all of the comic book movies. It seems like the hero only wins by the skin of his teeth. Like the villain can sit there and wail on them for like a full 5 minutes. The hero gets in two shots and the fight is over. And that frustrates the hell out of me, because if I'm getting beat that badly, the ass-kicking that follows once I finally get my footing is going to be epic and legendary, and my children's children will talk about it. So I like the concept.
I can see your point there.
I like the concept of a fight that's a little more evenly matched. I don't want like the, you know, where like I punch you, and then you punch me, and then I punch you, and you punch me. You know, there's a balance there that just is gone.
Right.
These days. So.
Well, this one definitely had some tit for tat, and I think the Mastermind pulled a really awesome move in making that illusion of the elephant.
Mm-hmm.
On 16 there, whenever Magneto's flying away in his ship, you can tell by the shape that it's powered by magnets, because the bottom of it, it's a magnet.
It's so dumb, and it's even wearing a helmet.
It is. It's wearing a helmet. That's funny.
Crap, that's not an elephant. That's a rhino. I've been wrong this whole time.
Elephino.
I wasn't going to correct you. I was just going to let it go.
What happens when you cross an elephant with a rhino?
Elephino. Maybe you got changed in the essentials to an elephant.
I appreciate that. That's nice. I just looked at it wrong.
Why don't you just pat him on the head and give him a cookie? Yeah. Jesus.
Because I want all the cookies, damn it.
Well, you can't be a good patronizing son of a bitch if you don't give him the cookie. It almost looks like Magneto is not so much questioning Angel at the bottom of 16, but performing psychotherapy. Tell me your feelings. I don't want to talk to you. It's very sad and depressing.
My dad never 18. Loved me.
Well, look at you. You got wings. You're a freak. Oh. I mean, why would anybody love you? I mean, your life is... You should just kill yourself. That's my...
Speaking of people who should kill themselves, on page 17, poor Toad, he's been left behind by his beloved master who secretly hates him.
Magneto, I've got to return to Magneto. Something is leading me to him. I cannot resist. Oh, wow. That relationship's just real freaky.
Yeah.
Page 18, why is Mastermind smoking in a pure oxygen environment?
This is not the only thing that's going to go wrong with this whole in space
yeah.
thing. This is not the last logic fail that we're going to have.
the whole scene on the letters page out of nowhere.
Boom.
I keep forgetting that that's there. This whole, I hate to say this, but this whole like last fight is kind of disappointing as an ending.
Really? I mean, just beyond the logic fails, the ice bridge actually is a pretty nice way to ratchet up the action to an epic scale. We're looking at a huge backdrop, and if you look back at the last four issues, this issue took it to a level that we're more familiar with the X-Men. It felt almost like a Claremont era issue in a lot of ways.
I don't know. I guess just at this point, I've seen these people fight so much, I've just kind of lost interest.
Which is, you're not the only person who's going to feel that way, because there are going to be letter writers who, after only these three exposures of Magneto, they're kind of, ready for something else. Magneto gets kind of run into the ground in some people's minds.
And which is not the feeling you want from your arch enemy.
Yeah.
No.
So, are we gonna talk about that those last three panels?
Oh yeah. It was all a test. It was all a test. You passed. That would piss me right off. They had genuine concern. They're in danger. Dude was faking the whole time. I wonder if he just messes with them for his own amusement.
And it's like when Cyclops. but why, sir? He's just filled with so much shock and anger because the crazy bald son of a bitch thinks he's so clever with his.
See what I want. Is that shot, right? Okay. Of him going, but why, sir? And then the camera slowly starts zooming in on Cyclops' face as he goes, remember, this is a school. You can't graduate from any school without passing your final exam. Well, you've all just taken your final exam. Just as and that's when, as he's talking, the ruby red visor starts glowing more and more, brighter and brighter. And when he goes, just as I planned it, it's when he lets loose the beam, and you hear just the sound of like a melon splitting.
But the big schism between Cyclops and Professor X that's pretty much characterized the X-Men for the last several years, it starts here. This is where it begins, whenever Cyclops realizes that, wow, this guy, he can be uncool sometimes.
And I'm proud to say that you've all passed with flying colors. You've proven you can think and act for yourselves. Your training period is over. Congratulations, my X-Men.
Fuck you.
It could have been worse. He could have pretended to die for 10 issues.
Or he could have run off with a bird woman. I don't care
the
how
list
hot.
Of crimes grows longer and longer.
I'm sorry. I don't care how hot you are. If there's feathers involved, I'm out. that's all I'm saying. Well, I can't say that. I've never been seduced by a bird woman. I hope to never be seduced by a bird woman, but
if you think teeth hurt, just wait.
Oh,
ow! No pecking! No!
Oh my God! Stop it! Get that thing away!
Pick a little, cheep, cheep, cheep. Talk a lot, pick a little more. I really want to get a good large 300 DPI better scan of that smiling face in the last panel and put really inappropriate dialogue in the word balloon. Having said that, I really didn't like the end fight. I did think this was a really solid two issues of this title. And I'm kind of curious about what future stories have in store, because this was pretty good. This was Marvel at its best at the time that these stories were being published. So why did the title fail? So I'm kind of looking forward to seeing why.
Yeah, it's a ways away. because this book is bi-monthly for a long time, so even though we're going to go through the issues relatively quickly, they came out at like an eighth of the speed as we're going to cover them.
That's true.
Well, at the same time,
they
found out later that it didn't fail as badly as they thought it had. They just, the time it took for them to get the sales, you know, sales figures back was immeasurable. It was months. So about the time it went into reprints, they're like, oh, I guess people were buying it to some extent.
Yeah, I think they put Neil Adams on it. And then, like, the next month, whenever people hadn't seen Neil Adams yet, but the numbers weren't going up, and so they decided to cancel it. And then by the time they realized that Neil Adams actually did help to turn the sales around, it was all done. But that's far in our future. We're going to have another president by then, maybe.
So we do have a letters page, which was kind of uninteresting.
Yeah, really. I mean, just a bunch of people saying, wow, I like this. I think you got a hit on your hands.
Yeah, there are actually some interesting X-Men letters that were published in like Fantastic Four before the letters column ended up in this book. And that's where you have people complaining about the characters being cardboard cutouts and how the Beast is just a copy of the Thing. And that's when Stan Lee said they were going to inject personalities with the third issue, and all that stuff happened in another letters column. You don't have it in the X-Men books.
Oh, okay. I did not know that. I know there was a response to one. They mentioned it here, so that fills that gap in.
Somebody wrote in from Albany, Georgia. That's in the southern part of the state. It's very hot and swampy down there. So I'd make a southern joke, but I live here, so I can't. apparently, a special announcement section is that beginning with this ish, the Big Two, Fantastic Four, and Spider-Man now become the Big Five, including the X-Men, the Avengers, and Sergeant Fury. That's right. From now on, all the Marvel feature-length mags will contain letters page, or at least until we crack. To make it a little easier on us, we'll limit these new letter sections to only one page, so please keep your correspondence brief. Agreed? As soon as this letter page goes to press, Stan and Jack will begin the most work on possibly one of their most important collaborations, Fantastic Four number 28, which features the X-Men as guest stars. Guess we'll have to cover that.
I guess we will.
The story will be so different, so unique, that we're sure it will be discussed for a long time to come.
Define irony.
50 years later on a podcast.
Yeah.
And, of course, we hope all of you X-Men experts. Oh, look what he did there. We'll read it, enjoy it. Incidentally, Daredevil number 2, on sale early in April, features one of Spider-Man's most colorful foes, Electro. And as much as DD will probably be meeting the X-Men sooner or later, we're anxious to know how you like the mag. Enough said.
Actually, I can't think of a meeting between Daredevil and the X-Men. Not like a special thing. I mean, they both were in the Fantastic Four annual with the wedding. But I can't think of
there? It. Well, we're all there, and we weren't even born yet.
I can't think of a Daredevil X-Men issue. Like, ever.
No, oh, well. I really... No. I could be missing something, but...
We probably are, but yeah, it's not like they went out of their way to make that happen.
So we got some ads this time out. On the inside back cover, you can fill the gaps in your family's education with this amazing made simple self-teaching encyclopedia. There is something about the concept of a self-teaching encyclopedia that bothers me on an intellectual level that I can't even really begin to describe.
I will eat your
heart.
But the
books are pretty. Because reading 200 pages on a particular topic is actually going to make you smarter on it.
Training for big pay made simple, a quick new way to get into auto mechanics, back when you could worry about you can not worry about fixing a car and dealing with a computer.
Right.
Dynaflex, creepy.
You don't like his muscles?
No. A different looking selling grit ad with a guy with a kid in a suit. Anyways, the Hypno Coin.
And are you going to use that to make the women do what you want? Because that's what's happening here.
And apparently what he wants is her to walk around like Frankenstein. That's a weird fetish.
In 3-inch heels.
Don't knock until you try it.
New accordions, save up to half off on accordions. I would love to find a scan of this magazine where it says name Al Yankovic. That would make me happy.
That would make me happy. That's probably him. It looks like his hair.
Hodgepodge ad. Ooh, Yubiwaza!
Yubiwaza!
Yubiwaza is a secret, amazingly easy art of self-defense that turns just one finger on your hand into a potent weapon of defense without any bodily contact. I weigh only 98 pounds, yet I can paralyze a 200-pound attacker with just a finger because I know Yubiwaza, says Yoshi Inami, pretty Japanese wife of N.J. Fleming, Yubiwaza Master. And why is he a master? Because he made it up. I'm a third-degree holder of the black belt symbol of high proficiency in the Japanese system of self-defense. And right there, you know he's full of crap, because you know what? The belt system is American.
Yes.
These people, most fighting arts did not have a belt system. It was the Americans that kind of developed that, because we're the type of people that want a ranking system.
A grade level, yeah.
So, apparently, if you earn big money learning electric alliance repairing, you will turn into Pac-Man. That ad creeps me out. I can't even
look. Why are his eyes like that? I just don't get it.
Because he's been staring at electronics for so long.
They've carved holes into his soul.
Make money, get prizes. I think they used the same ad for like 30 years for these seeds.
It's good color after a while.
And the back cover is Abe Vigoda drawing a hootenanny. So, yay.
Good old-fashioned hoedown.
But that's... I like how they have the guy drawing is actually Albert Dorn, probably the greatest moneymaker in the history of commercial art. At the height of his career, he began a full-time search for people who like to draw. And at the bottom of this ad, it says, America's 12 most famous artists, Norman Rockwell. And at the bottom of the list, Albert Dorn. So, yeah, because this guy's like Norman Rockwell.
Be nice to him. He's going to die in 2 years.
What, Albert Dorn?
Yeah, he dies in December of 65.
How do you know that?
This is the age of the internet. You can know anything as soon as you want to know it.
Yeah, but why would you want to know that? Why am I Googling it right now? I gotta stop.
You can't stop yourself. So, elsewhere in the Marvel Universe, courtesy of Kang's Time platform at Mike's Amazing World of Marvel Comics, located at www.dcindexes.com/Marvel, looking at cover dates May and June 1964, Giant Man and the Wasp face off against the Human Top in Tales to Astonish 55, who later becomes the Whirlwind and then becomes really creepy toward Jan. Spidey gets unmasked in Amazing Spider-Man 12, and then has his first fight with Mysterio in issue 13, which makes Michael Bailey very happy. Michael Bailey hates Mysterio.
Not a really big fan of Mysterio.
How can you hate Mysterio? Because
he's got a big fishbowl on his head. And yay! I mean, I'm sorry, every Mysterio story is the same.
Okay.
I'm not going to argue it. I feel differently about it, but I understand where you're coming from. So I'm not going to argue with you on that. The Fantastic Four 26 wraps up their fight with the Hulk with the assistance of the Avengers, who I say assistance meaning they actually get in the way a lot, but then they decide to work together at the very end. And then they get Doctor Strange's help against the Submariner in issue 27. Tales of Suspense 53 has the Black Widow return against Iron Man, plus the origin of the Watcher. Turns out all the televisions on his world stopped working. So he decided to go watch planets instead. Then Iron Man goes after the Mandarin in issue 54 with a new helmet design. The Avengers return to one of Thor's old foes as they fight the Lava Men in the Avengers 5. And speaking of Thor, he finishes up his first scuffle with the Enchantress and Executioner in Journey into Mystery 104, which has a really awesome cover of him being Superman, before getting some more double-time action with the Cobra and Mr. Hyde in issue 105. And then, as Michael said in the special announcement section, Daredevil rips off a Spider-Man villain for his second issue, and that would be Electro. Strange Tales 120 is kind of an important issue for this month.
Yes, it is. It's the second appearance outside of the X-Men book. Third, I guess, if you count Avengers. It was actually on stands on February 11th, 1964, with a May 64 cover date. And the issue features the teenage masters of heat and cold fighting side by side for the first time. The Human Torch meets Iceman, and apparently it had to happen, according to the cover. It had to. So on the cover, the two are side by side, a crowd of innocent people behind them, and a colorfully dressed pirates, a group of pirates pointing guns in the foreground. And the tale actually begins at the Baxter Building, where Reed is testing some new equipment as Johnny Storm, a.k.a. the Human Torch, as if anybody would know who Reed is if they don't know who the Torch is. Anyway, he looks at the newspaper, which is covered with news about the X-Men. Johnny specifically takes notice that the paper describes Iceman as a frozen version of the Human Torch. Johnny doesn't linger on it too long because he has a date with Doris at that night, and they're taking a boat ride around Manhattan by moonlight. Meanwhile, at the Xavier School for Higher Learning, Iceman laments that he doesn't have the fortitude to ask Jean out on a date. And the professor suggests that Bobby may want to get out of the mansion for a while and see the sights of New York, a.k.a. go find some poon. And Bobby wastes no time in taking the... go out there and knock somebody up, Bobby. Well, Bobby wastes...
Catch a tail by the tail.
Yeah. Bobby wastes no time in taking the professor's advice and spots a brochure for the Gotham boat line. And Bobby rushes to the pier, but when he gets there, the boat has already taken off. Which is fine with Bobby as he ices up and pole vaults onto the deck of the ship unseen. And once he changes...
That's not how pole vaulting works.
Isn't there
you can't pole vault if your pole vault is not flexible. And, you know, ice is notoriously inflexible. Just saying, you can keep going.
Okay, thank you. This lesson in physics brought to you by John M. Wilson.
It bothers me, I'm sorry.
Once he's on the ship, he changes into his civilian clothes and scopes out the ladies, who all have dates. He does zero in on one girl who's looking out over the water all alone, and this happens to be the Human Torch's date, Doris. And the two actually have a funny standoff before pirates, led by the Barracuda, invade the ship, robbing the passengers. So Johnny springs into action, fending off a couple of the pirates and getting Doris to safety. And then Iceman also suits up, or ices up, and manages to take a pirate or two before the two teenagers team up, and Iceman gets frozen into a block of ice when Barracuda sprays down his ice shield. The Torch is able to thaw Iceman out, but gets tricked and flies directly into a canvas, which lights up upon contact. Trying to avoid starting a fire on the ship, Johnny leans over the railing and gets shoved into the Hudson River, dousing his flame. The fire continues to spread on the ship's deck, and Iceman uses some giant snowballs to put it out, and fends off a few more of the pirates to boot. The Barracuda coats the deck in gasoline, which will melt Bobby and actually burns his foot, so he's taken out of the fight and must remain on one of the lifeboats. And just in time, the Torch re-enters the fray and rounds up the rest of the pirates, but the Barracuda escapes with Doris in tow, and laughs as he is the only one to ever defeat Iceman and the Human... What in the world? My stutter came out. Iceman and the Human Torch. Barracuda spoke too soon because his ship hits an ice jam, which turns into an ice spire, lifting the boat out of the water and allowing the Human Torch to swoop in and save Doris. With the day saved, Iceman creates a floating ice path across the Hudson and heads home. And the Torch searches the ship, lamenting that he would have liked to have known Iceman better, but he's vanished. And Doris wonders if they stood face to face with him and didn't even realize it, and if Iceman has a girlfriend. Johnny figures the guy must have 10, and then changes the subject to the moon rising over the New York skyline. And that ends our tale, followed up by a Doctor Strange tale that I didn't read.
Doris's statement's right there at the end, because superpowers automatically make the opposite sex bend over backward for you.
Oh, it works.
Which is...
works great for Peter Parker.
And Johnny's never had any problems with Doris, so... The Torch's Strange Tales series is not the high end of Marvel publishing. This issue is better than most, but it's still not that great. The weird thing for me is the inconsistencies between a hero's presentation in one book and the way the same writer will write that hero in another book. For instance, Bobby, you know, in issue one, he mocked the other boys' wolfish attentions to Jean. Then by issue three, he got pubes and decided girls were interesting. And now, only 1.5 issues later, he's trying to ask out the one girl on the team. But he's so shy, and he always gets beaten to the punch by one of the other guys. And on the one hand, it's like a natural progression. He realizes that girls can be a good thing, so he wants to date one, and I get that. But at the same time, these are feelings that should be wrestled by a 12 or 14-year-old, and Bobby is older than that. I don't know.
I didn't.
What else did I?
The inconsistency did bother me, now that you pointed out. And it is. It's the same writer, same artist. There's nothing's changed here. And now, now that I'm looking at the pole vault, I'll never be able to think straight again.
Yeah, you say the artist is the same, but Iceman looks horrendously different. That first shot of him on page 2, you know, with that, you know, Jason Voorhees type forehead just bothers the crap out of me.
It's amazing how much Jack Kirby's art can be made to look extremely different and have extremely varying levels of quality based on who's inking him.
This is just kind of a typical way of getting two heroes together, and I guess, you know, the whole idea of this is, oh, he's hot and he's cold. I smell a sitcom. I mean,
it's a very, if you'll forgive this, Mike, a very Silver Age DC.
Oh, it is.
Idea.
Yeah. No, you don't need any forgiveness on that. Though I do think that sometimes the pirate looks like the Thing as Blackbeard.
The best thing about this pirate character is that he doesn't go away. He comes back in 3 more stories, and one of them's a Hulk story.
I wanted the final panel of this to actually, well, 2 final panels. Do you think he has a girlfriend, Johnny? A guy like him? Sure, he must have dozens of them. That reminds me, I mean, there's a big beautiful moon up there and the night is still... Wait a second. Did you just ask if he had a girlfriend? Yeah.
Push him in the water,
and then he just rides away on the boat as she drowns, because she can't swim, and he knows that. And that hair is going to sink like a stone.
on a mythology note, at the beginning of the story, Torch makes a comment, you know, that's sort of intended to, you know, help anyone unfamiliar with the X-Men to understand the story. He says, as mutants, they were all born with their power instead of getting it accidentally like the FF did. So I'm thinking that at this point, Stan Lee hadn't worked out yet the idea that the powers manifest with adolescence. And I'm wondering if it's going to take Roy Thomas's Origins backup feature around issue 30 for that idea to come forth.
It also makes me think that the theme song to this show should now be Born This Way by Lady Gaga.
No.
I like Lady Gaga.
I like Lady Gaga.
But it's not a theme to an X-Men podcast.
Your point is true.
I still need some selling on this one, David.
Whether you love him or H-I-him, capital H-I-him, how does that equate? Nice. Actually, I'm just curious to see your answer.
They were born this way. Baby, I can rip off Madonna.
But anyways, that's basically all I had. There were a few other wacky things about the story. Like, capturing the Iceman in ice seems like That shouldn't happen.
Let's get that Human Torch with a blowtorch.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, didn't on? I always think of Spider-Man and his amazing friends when he would build the block around him and then bust out.
Right, right. I need to watch that show again. Actually, I probably really need to not watch that.
I was
going to
say, it doesn't hold up as well.
No, you need to watch that. Oh, yes, it does.
Oh, okay, okay.
I need to watch it.
Damn.
I feel strongly about this. Like, stronger than I really should, so I apologize.
It's okay, I'm kind of amused by it.
Maybe it's because I like the show. Maybe it's because it's almost 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, it is. We're all getting loopy. This is when things get weird.
So before we start talking about things we shouldn't, the other issue of Strange Tales that came out in this 2-month period, number 121, had the Plant Man, his second appearance. He's another one of several random Marvel C-listers that will be teaming up together against the X-Men. We'll see that in about 8 months on the show. And Doctor Strange fights Baron Mordo in a Wax Museum, because he does that on Fridays.
He's really good at it, too.
Well, in terms of the real world, if you know, at the time you would be picking up this issue on March of 1964, things that would have been happening is March 4th, Teamsters president Jimmy Hoffa was convicted by a federal jury. Who didn't see that coming? March 6th, Malcolm X was suspended from the Nation of Islam, and he says that he is going to form a black nationalist party. On March 9th, New York Times versus Sullivan, the United States decides the First Amendment criticizing political figures cannot be censored, and Saturday Night Live is thankful. Also, on that same day, the first Ford Mustang rolled off the assembly line at the Ford Motor Company. And on March 12th, Malcolm X leaves the Nation of Islam. March 14th, a Dallas, Texas jury finds Jack Ruby guilty of killing John F. Kennedy assassin Lee Harvey Oswald. I wonder how long the jury had to take to figure that out. We have video of it. And on March 15th, Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor marry for the first time. And on March 27th, the Good Friday earthquake, the most powerful earthquake in U.S. history, at 9.2, strikes South Central Alaska, killing 125 people.
Oh, that was awful. Yeah. I watched a History Channel special on that.
It decimated. I mean, it pulverized the town. And then on March 30th, Merv Griffin's game show Jeopardy! Debuts with Art Fleming, later to be replaced with Alex Trebek.
I love Alex Trebek.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I love his 80s afro.
And that was what happened in March of 1964. And that brings this episode to another close. We do want to note that we know there are emails. We have an odd recording schedule, so we are not ignoring you. We are aware of it. And coming up at some point fairly soon, we will do an email episode. Right?
Yay!
Okay. You guys got quiet. Like, wait.
I'm excited.
Yeah. But we do.
I am too.
Yep. We do appreciate your email. Appreciate the support. The download numbers have been really good. So, I mean, got a lot of good feedback. I'm really enjoying this, guys.
Oh, it's been great.
We expected 5. We wouldn't get like 7 or 8 people listen to the show. It's been awesome.
We may be at 9. Be still my beating heart. But that brings.
That's just crazy talk.
That brings another episode of Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters to an end. Thank you guys for listening. I am J. David Weider.
I am Michael Bailey.
And I am John Wilson.
And we will see you next time. You can find Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters on iTunes and at xavierspodcast.com. To get in touch with the show, you can drop us an email. The address is xavierspodcast@gmail.com. And you can become a fan of the show on Facebook at facebook.com/Xavier's Podcast. Until next time, thank you for listening.
Yes, the X-Men have won, but only for now. Magneto is still out there, waiting, planning, plotting the destruction of the human race. But whatever the challenge, whatever the peril, the X-Men will be there.